Should politics and social issues play into who serves on the board that governs Iowa's public universities? This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Only one of Republican Governor Terry Branstad's three nominees for the Board of Regents was recommended by the Senate Education Committee last week. The board has fallen under a lot of scrutiny in recent months, and now there's even more heat in the nomination process. We'll talk with Senator Herman Kornbach, the chair of the Senate Education Committee, about it. But first, should the time students spend in schools be counted in days or hours? We'll talk with a lawmaker and members of the Iowa Association of School Boards about a bill that would have the school year measured in hours, not days. Join our conversation after this news. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Lawmakers here in the Iowa Capitol are poised to approve legislation that does away with the 180 instructional days requirement school calendars are based on. It changes it to 1,080 instructional hours. Proponents say it would give local school boards more say over how to design the school year. Iowa is one of 18 states and the District of Columbia that still uses a days calculation. But those that oppose the bill say cash-strapped school districts might set hours based on their budgets, which could be a problem. Here in the Iowa State House Law Library, I'm joined by Representative Mary Masher, an Iowa City Democrat and member of the House Education Committee, also a retired teacher. Thanks for being here, Representative.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also to Tom Downs, Executive Director of Iowa Association of School Boards. Tom, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Mary Gannon, attorney with the Iowa Association of School Boards. Mary, thanks for also being here.
Thanks, and good afternoon.
And we welcome River to River listeners to be our guests, too, as we're discussing this. Parents, do you favor hours instead of days or days instead of hours? Give us a call. Join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Reach out to us on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio or tweet us at IPR Talk. So, first of all, Representative Masher, does the change mean any more or less time spent in school than under the current system?
It depends on the school district. There are school districts currently who are over the 1,080 hours. There are school districts and buildings below that level. And so for some, it will mean changes. For others, it won't. It just depends on where you are on the continuum and whether you're above or below that number now.
And during the committee, you were opposed to this bill, correct?
Correct. I voted against it for a number of reasons. One being, I do not believe it has anything to do with education reform or improving instruction in the classroom. We know that the most important thing to provide kids a quality education is to have a qualified, capable teacher in every classroom. And that's really what I think we should be focused on. The hours versus days really doesn't have an impact on that. And I think it's much ado about nothing. But I'm concerned about districts reducing the amount of time that they're with students and going to a lowest common denominator. Those that are above it may choose to go even less in terms of the hours of contact with students. And I'm not sure that's in the best interest of students. I also worry about districts where they are cash-strapped, and we know that's occurring throughout the state, where they may choose to go to a four-day work week for students, again, with a longer day, which, again, I'm not sure is in the best interest, especially of younger kids. I look at that kind of contact time and what would be done during that instructional day, and, again, is that in the best interest of children, or are the decisions being made because of money only?
So your vote against it was more of a way of saying, let's focus on something more important than this.
Correct.
Okay, so Tom, I guess, how would you weigh into this?
Well, I would agree with the representative that focusing on the quality of the teacher is the most important part of ed reform that we support and that school boards certainly support. I also would agree that there are many districts in Iowa that are above the minimum time and agree that the cash-strapped districts have many challenges. I don't believe this particular change will affect most of our districts, and I really believe that schools recognize this whole instructional day conversation is about protecting quality instruction time for that teacher with those kids. And I think it provides flexibility for districts that in a year like this, where we have local schools now thinking about 4 and 5 makeup days due to snow, and we have superintendents trying to make decisions about how do I support my student body participating in the state tournaments when my team's playing, but still have to protect instructional time. Our support for this is simply based on we believe local school boards will make decisions in the best interest of their kids, and this provides greater flexibility. Much like the representative, I don't believe it's going to have a major impact in changing what we're doing locally. But we support the flexibility, and like the representative, we still believe the focus needs to be on ed reform, quality teachers, and on ed funding, sustainable school funding through allowable growth.
So flexibility, let's talk about that, because that is the word that keeps getting thrown around. What really can a local school board do differently with the hours versus days?
I'd like Mary to enter into this conversation, because she represented us on this task force last summer that looked at the instructional day, and we've both talked about the need for flexibility. Mary, give some examples that you and I
Mary shared. Gannon, an attorney with the Iowa Association of School Boards.
Thank you. I think what it really boils down to, and as Tom said and Representative Masher said, it's really about the quality teacher in the classroom. That's truly we know that's truly what's going to make a difference. But there are some times when schools need some flexibility. And if you go back to the year of 2009, 2010, when we had that horrible winter where we had snow on the ground, remember, for probably about 180 days, actually, that we had schools who were having to make up 13 and 14 snow days, especially our friends up in Northeast Iowa. They just had well into the double digits. And they were asking for some flexibility from the Department of Ed, and the department really didn't have any statutory flexibility to give them, short of them going into basically the third week in June is where they would have been letting school out. And we know that's not optimal. We know how kids are after about Memorial Day. And if it's a nice spring, it's earlier than that. And what the department then decided to do was to allow them the flexibility to add time at the end of the school day to make up those 12, 13, 14 days, whatever it was. This would allow schools to do that on their own. They wouldn't have to appeal to the department, and then the department have to figure out, how are we going to do this? It would allow them to add those additional days to make up that time in an hourly standpoint as opposed to a day standpoint. And the other issue is that this year we've had quite a bit of snow as well, and those of us in this part of the state, we're sitting at 4 and 5 snow days. If your team got into the tournament this year and you wanted to close school down to send somebody, send the school down, which they all do, and you're already sitting at 5 snow days, there's no way they could take an afternoon off to come down here because they needed to have that class time available to them. And so this would allow the local community to make the decision that, yes, we're going to shut school down for an afternoon to allow people to come down to whether it be a wrestling tournament, basketball game, football game, whatever it might be, and give them the flexibility then to make up those 3 hours someplace else as opposed to trying to tack it on, trying to keep the kids in school and trying to keep buses running, all of those issues that come into play there.
River to River listeners, are you a parent? Do you favor hours instead of days? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Reach out to us on Twitter at IPR Talk or on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio. Also want to go now to Hayes in Cedar Rapids. You have a comment, Hayes. What would you like to say?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm not a parent yet, but both of my parents are teachers. My question would be, to any one of your guests, I know that they mentioned that some districts currently meet the hours requirement and some do not. Do you see a correlation between districts that do meet this level currently and higher student performance, and then vice versa for districts that do not and lower student performance?
Representative Masher, you're shaking your head.
I don't believe anybody has done any studies to determine that. I don't think we have anything out there that would indicate one district does better because they have a longer school year or longer days than another district. So I don't think there's any data out there that would substantiate that at this time.
Okay. Hayes, thanks for your call. We'll go now to Paul in Des Moines. Paul, what's your comment?
Yeah, hi. I can't remember who exactly said this, but they voted against a certain bill because they were worried that it was taking place of more important issues. And is this issue kind of dampening the discussion of lengthening the number, the school year? I know worldwide we're at 180 compared to like Germany and Japan, which are well north of 200 days. We still base our education system on the agrarian system, so I'm just wondering, is there any discussion of that?
Mary Gannon, you want to weigh in there?
Sure. Paul, that was actually one of the issues that was addressed this summer during the Instructional Time Task Force. There's an organization, I think it's called Innovative Learning, something like that, out of Boston, that's done quite a few studies on that. And there is some data that tells us, obviously, that the more kids are in school, and I'm talking longer school year, not longer days necessarily, that the better off they are, especially those students who are from high poverty areas, that they do get a lot more throughout the longer school year, as well as fewer breaks throughout that, fewer long breaks throughout that school year really does make a difference.
Tom, yeah.
You know, I think we agree with Paul, and I think all of us on this panel would recognize that time is the one factor that we look at that we need more of. We need more time for teachers to collaborate and for professional development. We need more time on task for kids. We need flexible calendars. But, Paul, one of the challenges we have is I believe the task force reported that adding one additional day to the calendar year contractually would cost the state another $15 million. Think about that from, again, a funding perspective. I know money doesn't drive everything, Paul, but certainly it is a factor we've got to be looking at as a state and that we look at when we talk about international comparisons.
And Representative Masher, Paul, I think, was referencing comments you made earlier about the vote.
And, Paul, thanks for the question. It's a great one because what we do know, Mary had talked about the fact that low-income kids would benefit a great deal from a longer school year, which is why in the ed reform package in the Democratic Senate, they are looking at how we can provide summer school for those at-risk families and at-risk kids. We know maybe not all kids need, you know, a year-round school and more days, but we definitely know that our low-income families and kids who are in poverty would benefit from that a great deal. And so it's one of the reasons why they have put in provisions to address that in the ed reform package and to really and truly look at how can we provide additional days for those families and kids.
Bill in Des Moines writes, "The Des Moines Public Schools releases all students 1.5 hours early every Wednesday for teacher development and collaboration. Multiply that by the number of weeks in a year, and that amounts to about 6 days of lost direct teacher-to-student instruction per year. Des Moines Public Schools kids effectively go to school 174 days. Mary Gannon, you're shaking your head no?
Well, I think from a day's standpoint, I'm not going to do the math on that, but when you get to 1,080 hours, what that is 6 hour school days multiplied by 180 days. So that's how we got to the 1,080 hours. The average school is in school longer than that. I think the Des Moines kids are in school for 7 hours. And so I actually did the math on Des Moines since I thought it might come up because mm-hmm. of their regular early out on Wednesdays, as many schools do. And if you look at that there's 60 hours, the amount of school time in there, you've still got 60 hours left over. So I think Des Moines will be in fine shape. They're probably over the 1,080 right now because mm-hmm. of the 7-hour school day that they already have. And in that 7-hour school day, we can count. The only thing we can't count is lunchtime. And so we can count recess if there's a teacher available for oversight, as well as parent-teacher conferences. So professional development would not be included, which is that early release time. But I think if you look at the numbers, most schools aren't going to struggle with that.
Representative Masher?
This is where we get into the issues that there's going to be a lot of differences. In Iowa City, in our district, they do not count parent conference days as instructional days for students. They haven't done that since day one. Those are additional days that obviously teachers are contracted for, but it is not a student instruction day. This bill would allow that, which is, again, I think there are many districts that haven't been counting those days as instructional days that will now, which I think will again result in going to a lowest common denominator. We also asked questions, Clay, about what about pep assemblies? Are you going to allow that to be instructional time? Well, the bill is silent on that. Well, everybody agreed that that shouldn't be counted, but you and I both know that if it doesn't say it can't be, it will be. And the same with awards assemblies or talent shows, or we gave in our district, we have there are student days where they go out and work in the community, and they provide that work and leadership in terms of helping elderly in their homes, doing those kinds of things. That we think should be an instructional time, because obviously it's part of their giving back to the community and helping. I think there are some districts where they won't count that. And so you're going to have a lot of discrepancies. Seniors get out a week early. There's nothing about that in the bill. And so we get into the situation again where seniors may graduate and then be expected to come back. I don't think that's in the best interest of schools or kids either. So those are some things I think we need to take a look at and continue to have discussions about.
This is a. Did you want to weigh in there, Tom?
I recognize Bill's comment about professional development time costing us time on task for kids. But as the research indicates, the time that teachers need to work together, to collaborate, to plan programming and instruction for kids is so valued. And Paul mentioned the possibility about the correlations between, time and student achievement. We do know there's correlation between quality teacher prep time and collaborative time and student achievement.
We're getting a lot of good calls in right now, and this is a good time to bring in Jan from Hiawatha. Jan, weigh in here.
I taught for 34 years, and all these things that you're mentioning that come up during the day, when you start adding them up, each one is an interruption of instruction. And when you're teaching the basic subjects, if you have a day and then there's an interruption in a day and you're trying to teach a concept in sequence, it becomes very difficult. And none of the things that you're mentioning are bad. They're good for kids. But I suggest that they be put outside the school day, including pulling kids out for sports, in service for teachers, assemblies, because all of that takes away from the instruction time, and it also takes away from your ability to teach when they interrupt a sequence of days that you're trying to teach something. And they do that in other countries. The extra things are outside of the school day. So when you're talking instructional time, it should be on the basic instruction in all the subjects, and I'm including music and art in that, and physical education, but the extra thing should be another time of the day. Thank you.
So are you suggesting that extracurricular, not extracurricular, but the specialties like gym and music and those classes, that those be taken on a separate time?
No, I'm talking about the Tooth Fairy coming, which is a very good thing to talk about, dental health. But when you add them all up, the magazine sales in the middle school, we used to spend 2 or 3 weeks on that. Every morning we'd have 2 or 3 assemblies. Every morning we'd have to pull time out to meet with the kids to sell the magazines, talk about them, promote them. When you add all of the different things that are interruptions, it's a lot. And so we need quality time when the kids are actually in school, when we can teach and take those kind of things and somehow put them above and beyond. And I know that doesn't sound practical, but it does interrupt, and it takes away from when you're trying to teach the basics.
It might not sound practical to you, Jan, but there's a lot of head nodding around the table. Thanks for your comments. Weigh in there, Tom.
I would agree with with Jan that as an educator, a former teacher, principal, and superintendent, I continue to hear from teachers about disruptions to the instructional day with assemblies and speakers and other requirements that the district has to be responsible for, and would support that quality time on task is something we need to protect. The challenge with this is that we believe locally school boards know better their community and their tolerance for those interruptions and their desire to support those interruptions. So we still go back to this is a local issue. We believe locally our boards know what's best for their students.
Will this change the way teachers are paid? Will they make an hourly wage instead? Is there any language in there about that if we're switching to hours?
There was concern about that because there are negotiated agreements right now that are days, not hours, and so they needed to give them time. I think it was a 2-year time period that they'll have to be able to ramp that up. But that was discussed because obviously there are people in the midst of bargaining right now, and they're bargaining based on days, not hours at this point.
I would offer there that if this does become a negotiable situation for boards, then support from the School Board Association likely is going to change, because we recognize, as Representative said as we began, cash-strapped districts are going to struggle to continue doing quality work with limited funding. And if this opens up new contract obligations financially, local districts can't handle that stress.
We want to go now to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Craig, what's your comment?
Very interesting topic. It seems like an hour is a lot more precise measurement for a metric than a day, because in a day a lot can be hidden. And it seems like the homeschoolers spend less time and are more successful because there isn't all these interruptions and there isn't a lot of wasted time. So I just am all in favor of this because it's a more precise metric. You can have a lot better measurement of performance because you know exactly how much time is being spent on what's being measured.
That's the problem. Because the bill is silent on everything from pep assemblies to the tooth fairy to awards assemblies to concerts, you know, all of those things, as Tom said, are going to be local control. And so there is not going to be any kind of time on task study or mandate from the state in regards to that. And the teacher who called in about the instructional time, those interruptions are still going to occur. And obviously each individual administrator and building principal and folks is going to have to make those decisions, but there is not going to be a standard statewide.
So the concern really here is that it's not really defining instructional hours?
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
So how does this move forward? It's over in the Senate. How will it be considered over there?
It's in the Senate Education Reform Bill, which is, I think, Senate File 423, I think. And the Senate is planning on working on that tomorrow on the floor. The House has already passed it and sent it over to the Senate. And it's probably one of the appears to be one of the areas of agreement, at least if you want to look at the whole education reform package, that the Senate has it in their bill and the House has already passed it.
And I also want to mention, too, that we did reach out to Republican Representative Joel Fry, who sponsored the bill, but he couldn't make it because of a scheduling conflict. So now, is it it's too late to say anything else that can be impacted with this bill, or does the conversation keep happening?
I think the conversation, it may be done at the legislative level just because they're in agreement at this point, and I would imagine if the Senate were to take up the House bill, they probably don't want to have to send it back and bounce it back and forth again. But I imagine the discussion is then going to take place at the Department of Education when they draft administrative rules implementing the new mandate. And that's probably where the level of conversation that Representative Masher and Tom were talking about are going to take place as to how do we define instructional hour.
Okay, and we're going to have to end it there. Thanks so much to my guests, Representative Mary Masher, an Iowa City Democrat and member of the House Education Committee. Thank you. Tom Downs, Executive Director of Iowa Association of School Boards, and Mary Gannon, attorney with the Iowa Association of School Boards. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about recent fireworks here at the State House regarding the nomination process to the Iowa Board of Regents. IPR's own Joyce Russell will be here to put in context, and we'll talk with Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach, who chairs the Senate Education Committee, about why the committee voted the way it did and next steps. I'm Clay Masters. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Only one of Governor Terry Branstad's three nominees for the Board of Regents is recommended by the Iowa Senate Education Committee. But the committee passed all three onto the full Senate to be considered. Democratic members on the panel say there isn't enough support in the full Senate for current president of the Board of Regents Craig Lang and Robert Kramer, a businessman from Grimes, who also serves on the board of the Family Leader, a conservative Christian group. Joining me here in the Law Library is my colleague, Iowa Public Radio's State House correspondent Joyce Russell. She's here to give us some context. Joyce, thanks for being here.
For having me, Clay. I just wanted to remind folks of two fairly recent high-profile nomination fights. Back in the 90s, then-Governor Branstad recommended Regents President Marvin Pomerantz, the late Marvin Pomerantz, for a reappointment. And President Pomerantz had been had overseen a very controversial effort to eliminate duplication in the universities. And I should mention, this current Board of Regents is also doing a study of duplication, so they should kind of be careful what they come up with if they have their own futures in mind. But anyway, that duplication effort involved the sale of WOY-TV, which was very controversial, and Mr. Pomerantz was turned down for a reappointment to the Regents. More recently, a controversial appointment was during the Vilsack years. Jonathan Wilson, who is a Des Moines attorney and openly gay, and he was nominated for a position on the State Board of Education. And in a Republican-dominated Senate, his nomination went down. Both of those nominees chose to go, even though it was pretty clear the votes weren't there, they chose to go before the full Senate. And in very passionate debate in both cases, they both went down to defeat.
So all three nominations passed out of committee. What does that mean? That's just kind of par for the course, it sounds like.
I don't think I can think of a single time when the education committee would say no, we won't even pass this on. I mean, it's sort of a courtesy to the governor, frankly, to let the full Senate weigh in.
So, how will this impact the governor's ability to work with the Senate? Would you say?
I think it's too early to say that. You know, these folks haven't gone down yet, and the governor this morning at his weekly news conference made his case for why these people should be appointed, and in Mr. Lang's case, reappointed. Although he did make the point that reappointment is unusual, but he thinks Mr. Lang is unusually qualified. And we should say that, you know, Mr. Bruce Rastetter is here at the Capitol and has been repeatedly Regent President Pro Tem lobbying for Mr. Lang's appointment. So this isn't a done deal yet, and we'll just have to see how it comes out.
All right. Thanks, Joyce, for bringing us up to speed. And that's a good transition into this morning. Governor Branstad, in his weekly press conference with reporters, defended his Regent nominees. He says Craig Lang has been leader for 2 years, and under his leadership, outstanding things have happened. He says the board chose a great president of Iowa State, Stephen Leith. He said other searches haven't gone this well, and he says this one went on without a glitch. Another success Governor Branstad attributes to the Board of Regents under Lang's leadership is a successful search for president for University of Northern Iowa in Bill Rude, and the governor goes on in singing Lang's praise here.
Also, they have addressed the other issue that's been of great concern to many parents and students, and that is the tuition set aside and correcting that so that you don't have Iowa students funding scholarships for others. They also, under his leadership, have put together a task force that's going to be addressing transparency and the need to have greater transparency in the management of our universities. And probably the most significant accomplishment, for the first time in 30 years, we're looking at no increase in tuition. So that is really what I call significant and important leadership. It's important to continue to have that kind of experience. Not too many people get reappointed to a second term on the Board of Regents. But I believe that Craig Lang deserves that because of the important and significant leadership he's provided the last 2 years.
Governor Branstad then brought up the nomination of Dr. Subhash Sahai of Webster City. He's the only one of the three that the Senate Education Committee voted to the full Senate with a recommendation. Branstad says Sahai is an immigrant and his entire family has been very supportive and generous to the community of Webster City and the medical school at the University of Iowa. The governor says the board doesn't have a doctor serving, and someone with his medical experience brings a great deal of knowledge. Finally, he weighed in on his nomination of Robert Kramer, and here's what he said about his nomination.
Robert Kramer has been president of the Associated General Contractors. He's a contractor. Between rebuilding the buildings of the University of Iowa and the other projects going on at the Regents institutions, we're looking at over $1 billion worth of construction. We have nobody on the board right now that has the background in construction and building that he has. He was chosen by his peers to be head of the Association of General Contractors. He also served a number of years on the Johnson School Board, and Johnson has one of the finest school systems in the state. He and his wife also have been very generous in opening their home to a number of children, and I think have been foster parents for like 16. I just think they bring diversity, experience, knowledge, and expertise that we need on the Board of Regents. I believe that the legislature should look at the qualifications and the knowledge that they bring to the Board of Regents and not make decisions based on political litmus tests.
Now, that's Governor Branstad today during his weekly press conference talking about his nominations to the Board of Regents. We here at Iowa Public Radio News reached out to Senate Republicans who declined to come on today's show. We also reached out to the Board of Regents who also declined to come on River to River. And we reached out to the governor's office about getting someone on the show and got no response. But we did hear back from Senator Herman Kornbach. He's the chair of the Senate Education Committee, a Democrat from Ames. He joins me here in the law library to talk about the committee's vote last week and where they go from here. Senator, thanks for being here.
Where angels fear to tread, apparently.
So you moved the governor's appointees, Craig Lang, who's the current president of the board, and Robert Kramer to the full Senate without any recommendation. How do you believe the Senate will handle those nominations?
Let me clarify one thing first. The Education Committee was required to act on all of the governor's nominees to various boards and commissions, as are other policy committees, by the end of last week. And the committees have only one of two choices. You either recommend confirmation or you forward the nomination without recommendation. So there was not an opportunity for anybody to vote no, and our voting to move two of the nominations forward without recommendation. You can't construe that as a negative vote. It's simply that people were not at that point in time comfortable voting in favor. There are a number of people who are concerned about this and may be feeling in the negative direction, but I'm talking about how you construe that vote.
So why couldn't you support with a recommendation for these two nominees?
Well, let me first talk about Dr. Sahai, who is a very well-known physician, whose family has been very heavily involved in philanthropic activities in Fort Dodge and throughout central Iowa. He's got degrees from two of the three Regents universities, and he also attended Iowa State, where I teach. He's got a great familiarity. He's got a great reputation. He's an outstanding nominee, and he's going to sail right on through. He's terrific, and I thank the governor for nominating him. The other two, there are some questions about that. Mr. Lang has been nominated before, and I didn't get a chance to look it up. He was confirmed before. I don't remember whether it was unanimous or not, but he was appointed by Governor Culver. So his basic qualifications, I think, are established. But he has got a record in office, and that's something that we need to look at. There are some controversies there. Mr. Kramer, it's a very different situation. He has not served before, and so his basic qualifications are things that, he doesn't have a record, but the basic qualifications are things that we need to look at.
River to River listeners, how do you feel about the governor's nominees and moving forward? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Reach out to us on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Dan writes in an email. He writes, when the committee questioned Mr. Kramer, they went after him for his conservative views, saying that they wanted to maintain diversity and tolerance on the campus. He writes, well, if only those who maintain a more liberal position and think that the same as those more liberal committee members, isn't that in violation of the diversity and tolerance issue? Senator, how would you respond to Dan's email?
Sure. Well, let me address a couple of things there. First of all, this is not Democrat versus Republican. In fact, by statute, the Board of Regents must be party balanced. If all nine members are registered with one party or the other, it either has to be 5-4 or 4-5. There's some room there for no parties to serve as well, but in no instance can you have more than five members out of the nine affiliated with one or the other of the political parties. In fact, we've got both Democrats and Republicans on the board right now, many who have served with great distinction and who have done great service to the university and to the state. It's also not the Senate versus the governor, the Senate Democrats versus the Republican governor. The governor sends up, I don't know how many nominees for boards and commissions, probably well over 100 each year, and the vast, vast majority of them get confirmed. I would guess probably 98, 99%. So in most cases, we give the governor the people that he asked for, and we try to give him the benefit of the doubt. But we take our advise and consent role seriously, and we do occasionally turn some people down. With regard to Mr. Kramer, let me tell you the particular statement in his record that is of concern to me. This came up when the Des Moines City Council was considering including sexual orientation in its civil rights ordinance or human rights ordinance. Kramer was opposed to that, and he said, and this is quoted in the Des Moines Register, "We should not be elevating chosen behaviors to a protected class." Well, I think it's real important that one of the basic values that's absolutely necessary in running a university is that we are open. We provide equal educational opportunity. We have a supportive environment to the young people who come to us for an education. And that extends across racial lines, gender lines, religion, and sexual orientation. So I have some real concerns about someone who was opposed to using public policy to protect the rights of gay and lesbian people. Now, that was back in 2001. And certainly in the last dozen years, there are a lot of people who have changed their view on that issue. But Mr. Kramer was given multiple opportunities during his appearance before the Senate Education Committee last week to talk about how he may have had a change of heart. He did not express that. And so I have a concern as to whether he takes the right values into the job of being a member of the Board of Regents to set the right tone and to help provide that equal educational opportunity for all of our students.
So if these are his opinions, say he were to have them and not serve on a board like the one for the family leader, is it more if it's a personal feeling versus more of an outwardly expression by that?
I don't care what party he's a member of. I don't care about any other political associations he has. But we're talking about choosing people to lead our university institutions, and there are certain fundamental values like equal opportunity and also academic freedom, freedom of research, freedom of teaching, freedom of inquiry, that are absolutely essential to the functioning of universities. So people who aren't able to lead in those dimensions, I don't think are a good fit.
Who do you think is an ideal person to serve on the Iowa Board of Regents? At least one Republican member of your committee has said he wants to see more regular people on the board, including parents who pay tuition. What do you think?
Well, I'd have to check, but I think that some of the members of our Board of Regents, at least, are parents that either are paying or at least in the past have paid tuition. I'd have to double check that to be sure. Certainly, that's a worthwhile idea. And certainly, there are a long list of Republicans, I think, whom we could simply wave onto the board and everybody stand and applaud. I mean, if Governor Ray were up for the job, I would be thrilled to have him. And I can give you five or six other names off the top of my head, but if I mention him, I think my mentioning him would be a kiss of death. There are lots of Republicans who, if they were willing and able to serve, would make very valuable contributions to the board.
You bring up Craig Lang, and you talked about these controversies. We didn't really elaborate on them. Bring our listeners up to speed about what those concerns are that you have about Craig Lang.
Well, some of our members are concerned about interactions between the board and President Mason at the University of Iowa. One of the things that I'm concerned about, being from Ames and Iowa State, is the loss of the Harkin papers. Joyce earlier made reference to the losing of the sale of WOI-TV, which contributed to Mr. Pomerantz not being confirmed. I would say that the loss of the Harkin Institute, the Harkin papers, would be a comparable loss. Tom Harkin has been in the Congress for 40 years. He has chaired the Agriculture Committee. He is chairing the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. I mean, major committee assignments that affect Iowa and affect the nation. And his papers from his time in office would be a treasure trove for research and teaching and investigation. And his willingness to lend his name to an institute at his alma mater would serve to bring in terrific speakers and students and help attract faculty. I think that the loss of his papers and possibly the loss of the institute is a major blow to the institution. And since Tom Harkin is one of our alumni, it's really a major embarrassment to the university as well. So I think that those are factors that concern a lot of people and we'll get a lot of scrutiny as we move forward towards a vote on the confirmation.
Do you think this is going to impact Senate Democrats' ability to work with the governor on other issues this session?
Well, it hasn't been an easy session to work with the governor on a number of aspects. I, as chair of the Education Committee, have been working till the wee hours of the morning last night, but have been working very hard for the last 2 months, and a lot of others have, on education reform. And we're going to be bringing our version of the education reform bill to the Senate floor tomorrow. I believe it's on the calendar, at least, for tomorrow. And frankly, there are three or four reporters who, without any prompting from me, have concluded that our version is closer to the governor's version than the version that was passed by the Republican House. So I think we've had a constructive working relationship there. The issue of Medicaid expansion, however, hasn't been very constructive. So whichever way we go on the region's nominees, I think we have a lot of work to do to get done with the session.
And some critics have said you being a professor at Iowa State might create some kind of conflict of interest for recommending nominations to the Board of Regents serving as chair on the Senate Education Committee. What do you say to that?
I don't know that I have any personal benefit from whoever winds up serving on the Board of Regents. I don't think that concern is well-grounded.
Moving on to other issues away from the regent nominees, education reform, it's set to take up debate in the Senate this week. Where are we on that? Where are we on that on the Senate side?
Well, the centerpiece of the education reform effort this year, I think, is recruiting more and more high-quality people into the education profession, and then giving the good teachers we already have the opportunity to get even better through professional development. I would think that we could all agree that that's the main thrust of the governor's proposal. What the governor proposed was one model for doing so. And I've said publicly before, I'll say it again, it is, I think, a well-thought-out, detailed model that may work well for some school districts. But what's also become clear is that one size doesn't fit all. My view is that the governor's proposal would work better for a large district than for a small district, and we have a lot of small districts. And the other concern is that the school districts around the state haven't been waiting for, you know, us geniuses under the Golden Dome to hand stuff down on stone tablets. They've been out there working real hard at education reform and professional development themselves, and I don't want to tell those school districts that they have to back up and start over with some other model. So in the Senate bill, we've developed two other models in addition to the governor's model that can be used by school districts. They have the ability to choose among those three models, and if none of those three works, they have the ability, and we provide additional guidance as to how they could develop their own model. Unlike the House, I mean, the House faced up to this problem and basically couldn't solve it, so they said, we're going to make the whole thing optional. We're not making things optional, but we're giving our local school districts and superintendents and boards a lot more flexibility. We've had a lot of great feedback from school districts on that score. Now, the other thing that's gotten caught up with this is funding for schools and allowable growth, and that's also going to be contentious.
And in the first half of the show, we talked about instructional hours. There was a bill that would make schools base their school year on hours, not days. Mm-hmm. That's been roped into the education reform bill in the Senate. What is your take on that? I don't know if you heard some of the concerns that Representative Masher was voicing, but
I heard about the first 15 minutes as I was driving down, then coming into the building. I didn't hear the back half. Let me say this. I think that it wasn't roped in. It was rolled into the Senate Education Reform Bill. And it's because the Instructional Time Task Force was one of the task forces, along with professional development, that was set up by last year's Education Reform Bill, which was a broadly bipartisan bill. And so it seemed to me appropriate to bring that in under that umbrella. That being said, I think the days versus hours, I think the hours model gives local school districts more flexibility. I think Mary Gannon was very articulate on that point. It does propose some challenge to school districts to adapt. But overall, I think that the flexibility is a greater advantage. What was also said in that discussion, though, is that it is not nearly as important as teacher quality.
All right.
Senator, I hear the exit music.
Yes, that's right. Senator Kornbach, thanks for joining us on River to River today.
Okay. Quite welcome.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.